That song is called "End of the Line" from the Traveling Wilburys, and I'll tell you that is not only one of the best albums of 1989; it's one of the best albums, period. What a heck of a group! George Harrison, Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, Roy Orbison, Jeff Lynne. That's a heck of an album right there. We're right in the thick of it, talking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff about an incredible episode in their lives, a story that's now known all over the world. A couple of quick announcements. If you are up tonight, a live chat for Coast Insiders tonight, it starts at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 11 Pacific, with Peter Davenport of the National UFO Center. Check that out if you're a Coast Insider member. A second announcement, we haven't got into this yet, but Bob Lazar has always stayed away from UFO conferences. He's had hundreds of invitations over the years, as well as invitations to do interviews for all kinds of news outlets, and he's always said no. I think the only public appearance he ever made was as a favor to the people at the Little Ailey Inn, and has probably regretted it. But he's going to make a public appearance. I'm going to be there to introduce him and to do an interview at the International UFO Congress, February 18th in Arizona. If you want to check that out, I think that'll be a pretty interesting little adventure on our part. And then if you want to get on a mailing list, we created a website just today. It's called alienpropulsion.com. And I'm not promising anything. I don't know what's going to come of it, but we're just getting names and contact info for people who might want to have send questions to Bob or know what he's up to. And it's a project under construction right now, but figured we would take this opportunity to go ahead and make that announcement. We got a link on the Coast to Coast website. Coming up, we're going to get into discussing a couple of other alien or Area 51 whistleblowers who've come forward, including a couple in just the last few months, whether they're credible or not. Much more to come here on our final hour on Coast to Coast AM. Bob, in the beginning of the program, you mentioned that stuff leaks from Area 51 all the time. We generally know what goes on out there. But still, secrets are kept, right? You believe that secrets can be kept and that this one has been kept in a way. Because even if it leaks, nobody takes it seriously.
Yeah, that's one of the things they told me right off the bat. It's one of the easiest things to keep secret because it's so unbelievable. You know, unlike development of new war equipment, new fighters, new missile systems, things like that. But this is so outlandish. For generally speaking, it's a lot easier to keep secret, but that didn't stop them from, using extraordinary means to keep everybody quiet.
Yeah, they still weren't crazy about the fact that you started telling people about it.
No.
Did they tell you you're going to die? Did they ever threaten to kill you?
Oh, yeah. That was made pretty clear. I guess that hit the peak when they took me down to Indian Springs for debriefing after we were caught that day. And they were I really didn't think that I was coming back from there. In fact, I thought it was so unusual that we were taking my car. And that's I don't think I've ever mentioned that before, that about how much that concerned me, because I thought if we were taking my car, I knew they were taking me down there. Because we had been caught, and I thought they were going to stage some kind of accident with my car or something like that. And anyway, the fact that we were driving in my car is what petrified me the most. And but just fast forwarding it, it was mainly threats, and I was really surprised I was allowed to go home after that. And I don't know what their mindset was. I don't know if they still wanted me, or they didn't know how everything was going to play out. Or I really didn't know what was going on, and that's around the time that I believe I contacted you, because I just became increasingly scared that something is gonna happen soon.
The
And
main reason you came forward is to save your life.
exactly.
I mentioned before the break about different people who've come forward with bits and pieces of information. I've collected more than two dozen, and basically the people who tell me bits and pieces that do support your story. Other people have come forward with all kinds of tales. Milk carton kids are taking to Area 51. There's vats of human and alien body parts, and they're creating hybrids and all kinds of crazy stories that almost seem designed to discredit the overall story. But once in a while, you get somebody who comes forward who's hard to dismiss. One of those is Ben Rich, who was the head of Lockheed Skunk Works. If anyone in the civilian world would know this stuff is real, it would be him. And he made a speech before he died at UCLA. A couple of people, Jan Harzan from MUFON, were in the audience, and he said, "We have the technology right now to go to the stars. We could take ET home, but it's so wrapped up in black projects, it will never see the light of day." That's a hard one to dismiss, isn't it?
Yeah, that sure is. Now, I have to make a comment on that, not that in particular, but about the stories and claims you hear from other people. You know, there's always been a couple, relatively minor things that I've always kept to myself that I haven't mentioned to you or Gene. And this the only reason for this is should anybody come forward and really claim they were part of the project there or something, you have to tell me something that I haven't said publicly. And that's what
Right.
I'm always looking for. And that's why I haven't said a few things. And, that goes true, or that's true for, a lot of these people that have come out. The information they presented is the exact same thing, sometimes the exact wording. I mean, if somebody else is involved in the project, you have to know a little more than what I've said or have said it before me. You know, something has to be there. And, like I said, I don't follow UFO information or other, people making claims or get on the internet and search that. So, I mean, as far as I know, there hasn't been anybody that I can absolutely finger and say, yeah, I know that guy was also involved. But I'm always interested to find somebody.
Well, there's two things I want to mention. One, I want to ask Gene about because I know that it bothers you, Gene, to see this story. It's in connection with Roswell. Somebody came out a couple of weeks ago, a researcher who is pretty respected, who says, "Hey, we've got a photo. It's an alien photo. It's taken in 1947. We can prove the photo stock, the film stock, is from 1947. It's an alien who was the a body that was re the photo was taken at Area 51." What's your take on that, Gene?
Well, first of all, you're more of an authority than I am. This was allegedly from the Roswell crash, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Did Area 51 even, as an installation even exist in the mid 1940s?
No.
No.
Okay, so there's one problem with the story.
That's a big problem.
And secondly, I think Bob certainly would be the authority to appeal to. Bob, because a photo was printed on photo paper from 1947 or from film stock in 1947, does that have to necessarily conclusively mean that the photo was taken in 1947?
No, if the material was preserved, I mean, you could take a photo today with old film stock, and I don't know how good it'll come out, but you'll still get a picture. So yeah, there's no way to really ascertain whether or not the image on the photo was taken in 1947.
But I guess they had to go there. I mean, let's say there was a real photo of a gray alien taken in 1947, wherever. I guess they feel it's incumbent on them to at least prove that, at the very least, the photo paper was from 1947, because with the state of the art of special effects in today's world, you can't really prove anything with a photograph or a video when it comes right down to it.
Well, the other whistleblower who's made a lot of news here in recent weeks is a guy named Boyd Bushman. I've been looking at videos of Boyd Bushman and seeing releases of his for a number of years. He's been interviewed by some national television programs. He's a credible guy. He really did work for some of these major defense contractors, and he's crept up to the edge of saying we have alien craft a couple of times, but until he died in August, we had never heard him say it directly. And he came out with these statements that, yeah, at Area 51, we had something that looks very much like the sport model. I mean, the story that he told sounds very similar and consistent with what you've said, Bob. But there's somebody we know who interviewed Boyd Bushman a while back who has direct information about the credibility of this. His name is Jeremy Corbell. Both of you guys know him. Jeremy is on the phone right now. Jeremy, thanks for joining us for a minute. What were the circumstances of why you interviewed Boyd Bushman, and do you think he was telling the truth?
Yeah, hey guys, how you doing?
Hey, Jeremy.
And you. Hey. So, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we have to talk about this compared to the real story, which is very amazing, and I love listening to you guys talk tonight. But I went out to interview Boyd Bushman. We brought a prominent researcher with us to do the interview. It was my friend Ruben and myself for a production of a film that I was making and I'm still currently working on. And, you know, just to bottom line it so we can spend time on the more important stuff, I found Boyd to be a very nice person. He did have credentials, but I also found not a single unique, credible, or in any way tectonic, as you described in your intro tonight, George, about anything that he said. I followed every lead that he gave. There was nothing new. And he didn't claim in any way to have anything specific that was firsthand that could be verified. He was taken advantage of, in my opinion. And that's why we never aired the footage. That's why I'm not including it inside of the documentary film that my friend Ruben and I are making.
He's a real guy. Boyd Bushman is a real guy who you think was maybe led down the path. I mean, he had a photo of a little alien.
Yeah, I know he was. I mean, I know exactly who his primary source was on the, you know, in quotes, on the inside. I followed down that path, and it is an absolute scam. He got taken advantage of, and for the reasons I don't even know.
Do you mean just because of the alleged pictures of the craft and the alien, or his whole story of the involvement?
You know, Gene, it was like across the board. You know, when he talks about his insider, you know, who's active and, you know, who had hands-on experience, I did some digging and some researching, and I know exactly who that person is, and there's nothing of truth to it. That person works in no capacity in any way.
What reason would, I just don't see what was in it for him, an accomplished scientist and engineer, what would be in it for him to glom on to Bob's story near the end of his life? That doesn't make much sense either.
Yeah, and it wasn't just at, you know, just at the end, like he had kind of quietly been talking and relating some things to, you know, about Bob's story. But again, he didn't provide, like Bob said, any information that Bob hasn't already put out there before. You know, I followed a lead to talk with Dr. Edgar Mitchell because actually, Gene, you had said something to Lear that Edgar Mitchell had come out specifically to meet Bob after Bob came out publicly. And I just went out there, due diligence with my film, and confirmed that direct from the horse's mouth. Dr. Mitchell said, yes, I specifically came to Las Vegas to meet Bob Lazar, to hear his story, and I find it credible. And that's what opened me up to this whole thing. Now, I did not find that in any way going down the path of Boyd Bushman. And
I found Bushman to be kind of believable. You know, some things that he said leading up to this, where it went over the edge for me is the picture of the alien and a couple of claims that looks like he was really maybe involved with something similar to this research that Bob was doing. And then he got fed some other stuff that pushed him over the edge.
Maybe, but... You know, George,
you think they might have done that to discredit him? You know, they saw he was releasing information that, you know, was pertinent to national security in some way, so they just gave him a bunch of, you know, UFO nonsense or, you know, stuff that had already been out and, you know, try to discredit the rest of what he was saying.
Jeremy, your take on that?
Yeah, Bob, I mean, it's possible, but what really did he say? You know, what was unique? What was credible? What was tectonic? You know, what impact could anything he had said? That really, there was none. And Bob, he never claimed to actually meet you. You know, there's some bogus, you know, polygraph going around on the web. And like you said yourself, most of this is just untrue stuff. And, you know, if we focus back in on 2014 and the fact, Bob, that you're coming forward again, which is really the tectonic move here. I mean, George has said you're like the Snowden of ufology. Your story has been validated independently by George and myself in many ways, not only the existence of S4 and your work at Los Alamos, but, you know, the real story is this. You're coming forward again in 2014. You've dealt with machinery that's not from here. That has impact on the minds of human beings, on the minds of people. And my question, Bob, to you is, you know, how has all of this changed your worldview or your cosmology? It's got to have impact on you. And thank you for coming forward again.
Well, I don't know if I'm really coming forward again.
It's me messing with making you.
Yeah, George is very convincing about, well, come on, it's 25 years. You could do one show and, you know, and granted, a lot of time has gone by and, you know, it, but really everything I need to say has been said 25 years ago. There's nothing new and, you know, certainly nothing that I'm privy to these days.
Yet there's a whole new generation of people that have been born and grown up since then, and they like to know that you're a real human being and a real guy and like to hear you, see you, and hear you speak. So
I can understand that and appreciate it, which is one of the reasons why I agreed to do the that UFO conference, which I, you know, have historically stayed away from like the plague, but I figure it can't hurt to do one. So, you know, I agreed to do that.
Gene makes an incredible point, and it's true, Bob. I was 13 years old when I heard George and you and John and Gene. And, you know, I was that generation. You know, there is an entire generation of people, 25 years old, who has no idea about this story. And it's that important. So,
hey, Jeremy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention, you know, as you were saying, Bob, about coming forward and speaking publicly, it's one thing to read you and Gene's story in a book or a magazine article. It's another to hear you, you know, when I have made public presentations and include clips of our interviews, it changes people's perspectives. You know, once they hear you and see how sincere you are and that you're not going too far and making stuff up, I mean, the story is sensational by itself. I mean, it changes a lot of opinions to hear it from the horse's mouth.
Oh, and I can understand that. And, you know, to me, the people that think it's a fabricated story really have to look into it a little closer. I mean, I could make up a much more coherent story than this. This is, I mean, I've said that my life has played out like a really bad science fiction movie. And, you know, I think the information's out there, but it takes so much effort, you know, to go through and verify things yourself. You know, you've had, and you need to know certain people and have contacts and things of that sort to verify some things. But just getting on the internet and browsing around isn't getting you anywhere except loaded with a bunch of nonsense information.
Well, that's the real trick. That's the real trick, isn't it, Gene, is sorting through and separating wheat from chaff in this field.
Right, and I was really disappointed to hear what Jeremy had to say. I mean, I still don't understand why a man like Boyd Bushman would, and Jeremy said, well, he actually had been doing it for some time. Well, as all of us age and near the end of the road, you really don't know when you're going to die, so you can't go, well, I'm going to die next week, so I'm going to go ahead and unload this week. So I don't blame a man if over the course of the past 2 or 3 or 4 years of his life, he started, you know, releasing some of this information because nobody knows when the last day is. So I don't blame him for having done it for some time. And I still don't understand why an accomplished man like him would have any possible motive to try and ditto Bob's information.
I think the guess that you made during the conversation with Jeremy is probably pretty close to the mark, in that this is a guy that very well could have been involved at some level and was going to prepare to speak about it, and somebody fed him some stuff that he bought and went too far, and that there's a combination of truth and fiction. As we know, the people on the other side who continue to muddy the waters are a lot better at their job than people like I am at mine and trying to pierce the veil and tell an accurate story. I mean, these guys are good at this stuff. This secret has been held a long time, and the waters are still muddy.
And that is the most difficult information to sort through, is the information, or disinformation, I should say, that is peppered with some facts in it. And that makes it extremely difficult, you know, to identify as a, you know, bad information or a bad information source. So, you know, and that's, we've seen that in a lot of information that,
yep,
that's released. You just add a little bit of truth to it and a lot of nonsense, and, You know, it just it makes it very hard. And like I said, they're accomplished at their jobs. They know exactly what they're doing. And
we have one segment with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff remaining, and we'll maybe take a couple of phone calls from the public. Stay with us. Edie Brickell takes us into the break with her song "What I Am" from 1989. I should say, pardon my French, the name of that song, Où est le soleil, that's Paul McCartney. And I played that song for a couple of reasons. One, it's just kind of fun and goofy and obscure from a 1989 album, like all the rest of the music we're playing tonight. McCartney put that together with a collaborator, Elvis Costello. The other reason I picked it is because there's a music video they put out for that song. And in that year, I just thought it was odd that they had an animated flying saucer zipping around over a southwestern desert. Pretty coincidental timing, considering what we're talking about tonight, but that's a pretty cool song. We put a link on the website. We have one segment remaining with my guests, Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. And I have a question or two, big picture stuff, about how they feel, why these visitors are here, if they want to tackle that. And then we'll take a couple questions from you for my guests. Stay with us for our final segment. I remember the night back in 1989 after the story about Bob Lazar identifying him publicly for the first time after it comes back out of video, and I'm sitting on the news set and the anchor lady asked me a question. Well, hey, do you believe him? And it was a question she shouldn't have asked, and it was a question I should not have answered. But my answer then was, yes, I do. And the same is true now. I think I know that there are problems here and there. And there are holes that are hard to explain, but I don't think they're, you know, having lived with it for a quarter of a century and tracked down every lead possible, I still believe it, Bob. And I think of you and Gene every time this comes up, of course. And when I hear Bill Clinton on Jimmy Kimmel earlier this year talking about Area 51 and whether he looked into aliens been out there, and then President Obama this year becomes the first president while in office to acknowledge the existence of the place and the existence of the ET highway and all the places that this story has gone, still alive, still as hot as ever. Bob, do you, first you and then Gene, it's overwhelming to think how far this thing has traveled and what you have done.
It is overwhelming. And, you know, as far as believability, you know, you have to agree you're in an extremely unique position and, you know, are able to see it from a vantage point that other people cannot. I mean, you know, we went to Los Alamos together to, you know, see where I worked, amongst other things, your contacts and stuff like that. So, I mean, you're able to get it from another level where the average person isn't. And really, as I said before, at this time in my life, I'd really prefer people don't believe it, because, you know, the last thing I want is somebody to verify everything I've been saying and deal with the deluge of people and problems, you know, that would be associated with that. So, you know, when people ask me, what, you know, boy, how come you don't verify this? How come you don't? Because I really don't want this to go any further. It's been a big enough headache, and I don't want to relight that fire. So really, if you're upset because of this hole and stuff like that, that's the exact position I want you to be in. I really don't want to be, you know, burdened with this stuff anymore.
Well, I should point out that you're here and Gene is here because I kept twisting your arm about it. It was not easy, and it's never been easy. Not the first time, not any time in between. Gene, the same question to you. Bill Clinton, Obama, ET Highway, the Las Vegas 51s. I mean, you were right there from the beginning and all the way through it. It is overwhelming, isn't it, to think of what you have wrought? Is Gene there?
Maybe he fell
okay.
asleep.
I think, all right, Gene will be back. One other question for Bob, and then we'll go to the phones. Bob, in all the material you read and all the thinking you've done about it since then, any idea about an alien agenda, why they're here, what they're up to?
No, and I really have thought about that. You know, it was never, the information was never given to me about, you know, how we got the craft, what they're doing here, you know, or any of the big questions that we all would like answered. Really, how did they come into possession of 9 craft? You know, a lot of this is just mysterious. And, you know, what kind of relationship, if any, was ever present, with these creatures, or, did they just happen upon, crap somewhere? But I don't know. I that's a complete blank to me, and I've kind of separated that in my mind, because the, technological aspects, I was, as I said, I've been able to verify, had hands-on experience, research them, tore things apart, and, so that's reality in my mind. But I have to draw a line anywhere past that. I've never run into a extraterrestrial living creature. I haven't seen one firsthand,
Well, did you?
No. And I didn't, I wasn't privy to information that, about the, the origins of the whole project and where things came from. So that's as big a mystery to me as it is to you. And, that's just a blank, really.
Gene, I want to ask you the question.
It's an even bigger one to me after those answers, but go ahead.
Gene, I want to ask you the question you missed, but I asked you a couple of minutes ago, is you see Bill Clinton on television on Jimmy Kimmel talking about aliens at Area 51. President Obama makes a statement about it. The E.T. Highway, the Las Vegas 51s, the movies and books and all of that stuff stemming from the story that you and Bob told. I mean, it's overwhelming, isn't it?
Yes, but I mean, I would love the story just as much of it as someone else had been in my position. I mean, I think it was just time for it to be exposed. I think, I don't know if it's just because we're maturing or the whole world is maturing, but I actually connected to the fact that atheism is growing, and I think everyone's fear of death and our quest to find out, the basic questions of man, who are we, where'd we come from, where are we going to, life after death, God, these are things we all examine, and people are not accepting the old things that require faith from the church, and they're trying to find out what they can, however they can, and certainly if there are beings from elsewhere who are older than us, who have traveled the universe more than we have, people would definitely like to know what they've got to say on these topics. So I think everyone's minds are wide open to it. And I know people fear God, and nobody hopes more than I do that there's the eternal party that goes on after we die. But in lieu of not being able to know that, I think people are just searching for searching for answers, and I think this was a part of that search.
Let's take a couple of calls. Callers, I'm just appealing to you. The lines are pretty full, so let's get right to it when you get on the line. We're going first to the wild card line, Blair in Sedona. Good morning, Blair. You're on with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff.
Thank you very much, George. Well, part of my question was already answered, Mr. Lazar, but when you climbed inside of what you called that sport model, and you called it injection molded gravity craft, and you came up to the gravity console that you worked on, did you ever speculate what purpose this particular craft might have had and how it interacted with the pilots?
No, I mean, the craft's only purpose, because it was so sparse inside, it just looked like it was made for travel, and because, essentially transportation. Now, you would think for transportation for long distances, you would need, sleeping quarters, certainly if there is any kind of, creature similar to us. But again, because the travel time is so short, that really alleviates any need for any other equipment. So you basically can run it with just what we saw in there, or just seats and the propulsion mechanism. There's really no need for anything else. As far as how it was controlled, there was no instrumentation at all in the craft. There's nothing, we call them consoles because they stick up, but there was nothing on the top of them, no buttons, no switches, there's no lights. So how it was controlled, and more importantly, what I've always wondered, how, when we were running it through the test flight, is how the human controlled it. And I was never permitted that information, and that's always driven me crazy. And a lot of people said, well, maybe it was thought-controlled, which isn't too outlandish. But, you know, how would we even be able to interface to that, you know, at that time? So I have just as many questions as you do about some of the things in the craft, but I don't know how, you know, the humans or creatures interacted with the craft itself.
Thanks, Blair. And you were disappointed with the progress that had been made, or lack thereof. I mean, the fact that they'd had these craft presumably for a long time, it didn't seem like they were getting very far, right?
No, it didn't seem like they got very far at all. Now, also keep in mind, I didn't know about 80% of the project. So they may have had giant leaps and bounds of progress dealing with the metallurgy of the craft. And, you know, the on the Sport model, there are a ring of rectangular, I call them windows, but, you know, they're, I don't believe that's what they are, but they're black window-looking devices. And I've always believed the top part of the craft, you know, dealt with whatever their version of a computer is, and navigation system. I believe those were sensors, and that's how the craft was able to ascertain its position in space. But, you know, who knows? Maybe some of our technology has come from that. I get asked that a lot of times, too. But, again, it's all conjecture on my part.
Gary in Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Gary. You're on with Gene and Bob.
Thank you. Mitchell, I'm going to get right to it because of the other callers. I attended the United States Naval Nuclear Power School and was taught that there's four forces in the universe: weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, the electromotive force, and your favorite, apparently, gravity. Now, I was taught that the reason why uranium-92 is the highest on the periodic table is because the strong nuclear force is the force that holds the protons together in the nucleus of an atom, and that the strong nuclear force only works over a finite distance. And when you start adding the 93rd, 94th, and 95th proton into the nucleus, it increases the bundle along with the neutrons to where the cross-sectional distance is greater than that which the nuclear force can hold together, which is why they spontaneously fission. Now, we've gone up to about, I think, a mercurium atomic weight of near 100, but 115, this element 115, would clearly exceed the ability of the strong nuclear force to hold it together, which is why when we create some of these higher elements in breeder reactors and such, they only last for about a picosecond because they spontaneously fission into two smaller fission fragments because, again, the strong nuclear force can't hold them together. So given
okay,
that,
well, let me interrupt you for one
Gary,
second.
Gary, you're going to have to get to it here. Okay, Bob?
If what you're saying was true and it operated on a straight linear fashion like that, then you would see decreasing half-life from uranium on. And we don't see that at all. In fact, you know, 115, even the isotope they had a surprisingly long half-life. So there's much more than just the strong nuclear force keeping, you know, the nucleus together. And, you know, we see different jumps in half-life clear across the board as we go up in, you know, higher and higher in the elements. So that's it's not just that. I mean, there are what they call magic numbers and, you know, and islands of stability that for some reason, you know, certain combinations of protons and neutrons will produce a longer-lived isotope of an element than others. Now, I don't know that we even now know the exact reasoning for this. It's just an observation, but... you know, that does, in fact, exist.
Charles in Los Angeles. Good morning, Charles. What's on your mind? Hello?
I've heard John Lear two or three times over the years, and someone else also. And they say, have said, that we have had our own ships for, since about the 1960s. And I noticed most of the conversation tonight was around 1989. I wondered if you could comment on that for us.
Well, I never saw anything that led me to believe that we have duplicated or have our own ships. In fact, the whole scope of the project was to try and find out if we could ever possibly make them or duplicate them. Certainly, that wouldn't be the aim of the project if we had already had them. You know, we were working from a standpoint of, we really don't know what's going on here. Let's try and find anything we can and piece it together. And, you know, then the idea of phase two of the project was supposed to be, you know, see how this could be duplicated with available materials.
Thank you, Charles. Ben in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, east of the Rockies line. Hi, Ben. You're on with Bob and Gene.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Mr. Lazar, I saw a taped video interview with you 20-plus years ago, and you mentioned that at the time they would take you into a room and that there was a book you were allowed to view but not to remove, and that you did that several times, and you felt that there was information in that book that the public had a right to know. And you said there were even religious implications. Can you expand on that any?
Well, there were several books, actually. I mean, these were part of the briefings that I read. There was also one that was really unusual that dealt with humans and had some, I don't know, I know I've mentioned this before in interviews, it take too long to get into now, but even the pages were strange, you know, how they turned and the images would change on them. Yeah, I don't know who that was produced by or what for, but it dealt mainly with us and not aliens. But yeah, there's a lot of information, and again, they were just overall views of the other projects going on, and all of this information, you know, as I've always said, you can separate out the weapon potential portion of it, but just the existence of the craft and some of the information we got from it, the existence, you know, of other beings, intelligent beings in the universe, all of this, you know, really needs to be presented, not just to the American people, but to the world. This is too big of an important topic to leave out just because, you know, somebody's jealous of weapon potential. And, you know, there may be other reasons that I'm not thinking about, but, you know, all of that information I really feel needs to be presented to the world as a whole.
Bob and Gene, we got about a minute. I just want to posit this and get your reaction as final thoughts. I mean, it's, you know, you've said, Bob, that you at times you wish you hadn't come forward or you've rethought it and maybe you should have kept your mouth shut. But when you talk about it, when you get in a forum like this and you're talking to regular folks and answering questions about it, you get jazzed, don't you? Remember how exciting it was.
It was like it was a tremendously exciting time. It was a tremendously fearful time, too. But, you know, compared to our calm, quiet lives now being in our 50s, yeah, that was, like I said, it played out more like a movie. And, yeah, and you hear people that are genuinely interested in it, and, you know, and I like to relay what I know to people like that. Yeah, the ones that get you aggravated are the ones that...
Nitpick.
Yeah, well, not just nitpicking, but, you know, people that haven't taken the time to look at the information or study anything, and, you know, they're bad on both sides of the topic, you know, overbelievers and underbelievers. You know, just look at the information, and before you, you know, come up with a decision, you know, look at the facts behind it. And, look, I don't get any special dispensation from this. Everybody needs to use the scientific method and you know, look at things and proof, question everything.
But, Bob Lazar, we're out of time. Thanks, man. Can't thank you enough. I'll hope to twist your arm in the future. Gene Huff, thank you both. I'll see you in February at the International UFO Congress.
All righty, Joe. Good night.
Thanks, guys. Thanks also to Jeremy Corbell, Nathan Staten, Tricia Pepe, Dan Galanti, Chris Boros, and our webmaster, Tim Binall. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night with my guests, Robert Hastings and Tom DeLonge. Hope you can join us then. Good night, everyone.